This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace.
Last year, I went through many different life changes. I needed to take a pause and examine how I was feeling in the inside to better show up for the ones who need me to be my best version of myself.
When you're navigating life's changes, Talkspace can help. Talkspace is the number one rated online therapy, bringing you professional support from licensed therapists and psychiatry providers that you can access anytime, anywhere.
Living a busy life, navigating a long-distance relationship, becoming a first-step father, Talkspace made all of those journeys possible. I could speak with my therapist in the office. I could speak with my therapist in the comfort of my home. I was never alone.
Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance, no problem. Now get $80 off your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
Time. It's always vanishing. The commute, the errands, the work functions, the meetings, selling your car. Unless you sell your car with Carvana. Get a real offer in minutes. Get it picked up from your door. Get paid on the spot. So fast, you'll wonder what the catch is. There isn't one. We just respect you and your time. Oh, you're still here? Move along now. Enjoy your day. Sell your car today. Carvana. Pickup fees may apply.
This podcast is intended for entertainment and informational purposes only. The content shared is not a substitute for professional medical, mental health, legal, or financial advice. Please consult a qualified professional for personalized guidance or treatment. By listening, you acknowledge that the hosts and guests are not responsible for any decisions or actions you take based on this content.
Feel like a grouch, go beyond the couch, share your confessions on the Aurora Sessions.
Hello, Aurora Healing Crew. Welcome to the Aurora Sessions Beyond the Couch, where we take the stressors that come up in session and bring them into conversation beyond the couch. This is the space where real talk meets real life.
Hi, everybody. This is Teresa here. I'm the founder of Aurora Sun Counseling, a group private practice providing psychotherapy for clients in New Jersey, Virginia, and Pennsylvania. Today, Karen Helms, LPC, she is the founder and owner of Anam Kara Counseling and Supervision, is with me today. Karen, can you tell everybody a little bit about what you do?
Sure. I am an LPC. I'm licensed in New Jersey and Virginia. Currently own a solo practice, as you mentioned, the Anam Kara Counseling and Supervision. I specialize working with individuals that are affected with chronic illness and or their caretakers. I really have, over the years, worked in a lot of different settings, but when it came time for me to choose pretty much like a niche market, I really wanted to go with something that I was very passionate about.
Okay. Thank you so much for taking time out and meeting with me and being on the podcast. I really appreciate this. And just like my other guests so far, Karen has been a friend ever since we met. And we met many years ago. When you first started out, I think you were getting your hours. Is that when you first graduated? Yeah. And right away, I felt comfortable with Karen. And I think, was I pregnant at that point? Or was it right before I was pregnant?
I think it was right before.
Okay. Yeah. So that's more than almost 14 years ago, for sure. And we chatted, and Karen helped me with adjusting to new work environments because we worked at a middle school together at one point, and it was my first time doing in-school-based counseling, and she helped me set up, and it was very nice. So I'm grateful for our friendship.
Likewise, we've been on a long journey this far.
Yes, we have. Yes, we have. Can you share what motivated you to launch? And how do you say it? Because in my head, I call it Anam Kara, and I have Googled that before. Can you the name of your company, but also what inspired you to specialize in therapy for chronic illness?
Sure. The name of my practice is Anam Kara. counseling, and I think you can pronounce it either way. It's a Gaelic term. It's a very old phrase that means, you know, connection. It can be connection in the romantic sense. It can be a connection in friendship, family, bonding. I wanted a name that was very special to me. It was a phrase that I used, you know, when I got married, and it's something that has been in my family for years. So I wanted something more personalized since I knew it was going to be a solo small practice.
That's great. And what inspired you to work with chronic illness?
I have a personal history with chronic illness. I got sick when I was 14 with a neuromuscular disease called reflex sympathetic dystrophy syndrome. And having gotten sick so young and have, you know, how I had to really kind of adapt to it over the years really allowed me to learn a lot personally and then professionally when I started to get into the field. And I wanted to give back. I wanted to be able to help others that were affected by chronic illness. I think it's kind of a little bit similar if somebody works in addictions or with eating disorders. I think if you have a chronic illness, you just have a different view of the day-to-day challenges that you experience and how right. sometimes you need support to help you live that quality of life.
And with your chronic illness, with this specifically, can you describe what are the biggest barriers for you?
Some of the symptoms, the newer name, actually, they adjusted it a couple of years ago and they changed it from reflex sympathetic dystrophy to chronic regional pain syndrome. Mm. So one of the main components is full body chronic pain. That includes achy muscles, joint pain, extreme nerve pain, which sometimes can feel like burning, skin right. sensitivity. I would say fatigue, though. I think the pain is bad, but the biggest challenge that I have found was the fatigue part that sometimes, you know, that really zaps your energy and makes it hard to deal with the pain.
Okay. So you were diagnosed at 14. Can you tell us your story of how you were diagnosed?
With RSD or chronic regional pain syndrome, they believe that it is due to a trauma of some sort. It can be stub a toe. It could be a break a toe.
Wow.
It could be something that you really aren't even fully aware that you're doing.
Okay.
I had a very simple surgery on my foot.
Okay.
And they believe that that was the origin because it had started okay. in my foot and traveled up one side of my body down the other over the span of a couple of years. Because of the time that I got diagnosed, it took a good 2.5 years to actually be diagnosed because it wasn't an illness that had a lot of research around it. So it was a lot of being in the hospital. I was homeschooled for the majority of my high school years because you were in and out of the hospital and physical therapy and surgeries. So in the beginning, it was kind of like the blind leading the blind trying to even get diagnosed. You know, going to a lot of doctors definitely causes doctor fatigue and frustration and being told that it's all in your head, especially when you're a teenager.
Yes, that's what is going through my mind now, because pain is one of those things that is subjective, right? Like we are the ones, just like mental health, we are the ones telling somebody else the level of pain that we're in. So there's, you know, back to when hysterical, the origin of the word hysterical comes from women going crazy because they have a uterus or a hysterectomy or something. Like it's always been kind of like gaslit, or that it's hard to make people believe your pain. So
absolutely,
who were your biggest supporters back then? Because as a 14-year-old, I have an almost 14-year-old, so I cannot imagine on top of going through puberty and all the changes and moods and all the stuff and then dealing with this new diagnosis that involves pain. Did people believe you, or what was that like?
No, mainly the doctors, because it was such almost an invisible illness. There were times that there would be discoloration. There would be times that there would be swelling, but it wasn't always seen on the outside. So they were only really able to see it doing very extensive testing, but getting them to believe me to the point of actually doing the testing was difficult. But my mother, bless her heart, was extremely tenacious and never doubted me. So having her as, you know, she was definitely my advocate when it came to the doctors. My siblings, more so just because we were closer in age, and my best friend, I would have to say the three of them. If I didn't have the three of them, my life would have taken a different course for sure.
I think of you often because you don't talk about your mom a lot, and nor do we talk every day. But one of the few conversations that I remember you saying is that you have great memories of you and your mom going out to lunch together. So I try to take my own daughter out, and I always think about you, that this, like, I'm building those core memories that she is going to have. And the other day I did take her out and she said, I like having you all to myself. And I was like, Karen, this is because of Karen. Karen made that awareness for me. So I just wanted to share that with you.
Oh, I'm so glad.
Yeah. You never know what you say that will land with people, right? So one of the questions here, and I think this comes up in so many different medical illnesses and also comes up when people are, their bodies change in general. But how do you, this question is, how do you support clients who are grieving the loss of their pre-illness self? So again, you were diagnosed at 14 years old and your body is changing. You're learning about this new medical illness. Did you realize and how many changes you would have in your life, and what was that process like, and how did you support people going through the same thing?
For me, we had absolutely no idea. And I say we, just me and my mom at that time, we had no idea, and we didn't know the extent of the spread, because sometimes, you know, when they had the research, it was more so to the origin of targeted area of where it started. But having it all over, that blindsided us. And I have to say, every couple of years, there would be a different symptom. Even till this day, being 50, I have no idea. I know the prognosis is that there's not a cure. There is, by essence, the prognosis is a deterioration of the muscles, and the nervous system starts to break down. So that, you know, long time prognosis, but never, you really don't know what's going to come next, because it is something that attacks the nervous system and the internal organs. So you really just don't know.
Okay.
So I think when I'm talking to somebody else that either understands their prognosis, they might just have started on their medical journey, anybody that has had their life changed, either themselves or when you're a caretaker, your life changes as well. I'm very honest. Really just, you know, the illness or the pain, especially if it's chronic, by definition, is something that you have to learn how to live with. So I don't shy away from, you know, prognoses that might bring somebody to tears. I always say I'm not allergic to tears, so I definitely allow there to be a space for that. But I'm very brutally honest. I let them know that, you know, each day you really make a choice to wake up and put one foot in front of the other. And some days that choice is easier, and some days that choice is extremely hard. And just, you know, supporting them with finding what allows them to build a quality of life for themselves or extend it if they have a sense of it. But I'm direct by nature. So I think, you know, having experience mentally, you know, professionally and personally, people can connect with that.
Okay. So it reminds me of the little bit that I know of MS, that the symptoms changes and you just, and it's progressive and you don't know what new symptom you're going to get. And in this world where we need to know everything, and that is, I cannot even imagine just not knowing how you're going to wake up today. And if you could, as a therapist, go through a whole day of a full calendar.
That was one of the drivers, though, for me opening up my private practice, was being able to set my own schedule, being able to, you know, only have a set number of clients at one time. So that was definitely one of the drivers of me opening up my own practice, was having that flexibility because, you know, working in different settings with different policies and different, you know, business side needs. I don't know if I would have been able to work at a place that was asking for 40 hours a week and or a place that I would need to be in person. One of the savings grace was, you know, the ability to work virtually has helped me greatly.
I know we're going a little bit backwards, but I remember that therapy or becoming a mental health therapist is not your first career. What did you go to school for and what did you do first before you became a therapist?
I always knew I wanted to work in the world of psychology. Mm-hmm. When I got two undergraduate degrees, I have a degree of psychology from Stockton University. And then a couple of years later, I went back and got a social work degree. Bachelor's in social work.
Yeah.
I specifically wanted to go back. I had the opportunity to go for a master's right away, but I wanted to go back.
So I'm just going to backtrack a little bit. When you became a therapist, that was kind of your second career. Can you tell us a little bit about what you started out with going to school and what was your first career?
Sure. I always knew I wanted to work in the world of psychology. So I got a degree at Stockton University psychology. And then a couple of years later, I actually went back for a social work degree, a bachelor's level. I didn't want to jump straight into a master's program because I knew that there was more that I wanted to learn. And the social work degree allowed me to look more towards doing research because I actually wanted to do more of like the analytical side of psychology. I really wasn't thinking counselor or therapist at that time. I was thinking more grant writing and, you know, conducting more of studies. So in my internship for social work, I was able to get a job at a healthcare system, AtlantiCare. We both share some history with. And I actually started working in their community group programs doing research. And then over time became a data analyst, which was interesting for a good couple of years. But then I did really start to just explore more classes and found that I did want to, you know, explore the option of becoming an LPC to really focus in. I was able to be exposed to lots of different aspects of social work and psychology and behavioral health, and research is very important and, you know, glad that we still have people that do it. But over time, I did find that I really, my passion was in counseling. So I went back to get my master's from Capella University.
Nice. And you had such endurance, the long game of doing this, because were you still working and going to school at the same time?
Yes. It took about 5 years for me to get my master's because I was working full time and I was only able to take one class, sometimes two, but mostly one due to trying to work with a chronic illness and then also going to school. It was the long game, and that I use the phrase quite often that life is a marathon. It's absolutely not a sprint. So, you know, I have a lot of patience. So I knew I was going to reach my goal and it was just going to take a while, but I definitely got there.
And thank goodness you have a lot of patience, because I'm more of a impatient person. It's when you think about it, I think this is where we teach our clients, like, take it one day at a time, or mindfulness, and take little bites and not look at the whole big picture. Because if you knew it was going to take 5 years or how long it took you to finish your master's and all the hours, it would feel impossible. But you just had to do it one class at a time.
One class at a time. And then, you know, the years that it takes for us when we, you know, our provisional license and then our secondary license, it is a sacrifice that you make. And it is definitely endurance, no matter who you are. But knowing that there was going to be light at the end of the tunnel that would allow me to work smarter, not harder. Getting sick so early did give me the hindsight of knowing that my body was not going to be able to do anything physically taxing, that I really had to make sure that my career included my mind.
Yes.
That when my body started to break down physically, my mind, it will still be sharp. So I really wanted to, you know, definitely settle into something that I could do for the long haul.
Do you remember before your diagnosis, what you wanted to be when you grew up?
I don't know if I had a clear idea. I know I wanted to help people, but my fascination, honestly, was more of, I always found the mind interesting. I was, you know, definitely always interested in the topic of eating disorders, just various topics in psychology. I didn't know at that time really, you know, I didn't think that I, you know, therapist in general was going to be my calling, but
right.
I was always fascinated with how the mind worked. I really, that, you know, I had to say, like, you know, I do love helping people, but I like the challenge of how different we all are and how different we are as we go through the different life cycles. It's always been fascinating to me, and it's still fascinating to me.
So chronic illness, by definition, is ongoing and doesn't have a cure, has lots of layers of grief that comes with it. How do you support the clients, or what are some things that you tell the clients without trying to like fix them, or because there is no fix? So what are some coping skills that you had to use or the clients have to use when they're just feeling maybe a lot hopeless about the situation?
I use a couple of different therapy styles. I use acceptance and commitment therapy. I use cognitive behavioral therapy. I use often narrative therapy. And the different therapies that I use are very action oriented. So one of the things I really start with, in addition to building rapport with a client, is having them understand that they're the captain of their ship. When you are sick, you feel like you don't have any control over your body. When you need to go to doctors, you don't feel like you have any control over your body. So I start off very early, really almost kind of like becoming a teammate with my client and allowing them to know that they can learn different skills. We can learn to, you know, think positively, not negatively, but in a realistic, non-cliche way. Getting them on board, allowing them right away to see that they can change how they think. They can't change their prognosis most times. Sometimes they can help extend it, but you can change how you see the world and how you identify yourself and how you identify yourself with a chronic illness. So quick wins early on and allowing them to feel some sense of power.
That is very similar to something that Amy Ray, our previous guest, had said. She's the nutritionist. She said that she has the client kind of figure out what works best for them. And a lot of times that's, as a therapist, like that's what we say. It's like, what are your goals? What do you want? And then, so this is very similar to all of that as well.
Yeah, it's me and the client where they're at, you know, understanding really what their day-to-day does look like. If they need some community resources or additional resources or different, you know, team members, you know, working with their pain management doctor, their psychiatrist, really seeing where they are and if they are ready for therapy. Sometimes, you know, we have clients that want it, but they might not be just ready for it yet. Or you take those small bites and you help them get ready and know that they have support.
What do you tell clients who maybe don't have the option of a job that requires, like, that allows you to use your mind? Like, because there's a lot of people who develop chronic illness later in life and didn't, I guess, not that it was like a silver lining to be diagnosed that young, but like they've already been to college and then they develop a chronic illness and then they have to like kind of switch or be disabled. Or what is your process with the people who have to give up their employment or their careers?
I do, as odd as it sounds, do find that it was a blessing that I got diagnosed so young.
Right.
It really did change the direction of my life completely. When it's somebody who has, you know, gotten to that point where they either have to switch careers, switch jobs, or start the process of becoming, you know, disabled and not being able to work anymore, really assisting them with grieving the loss of their job. Grief is going to be an ongoing thing. It's, you know, it's almost like an accessory that comes with chronic illness because you're always grieving something. You're grieving what you expected life to be. You grieve the job that you can no longer do. If there is any way for somebody to step down in their job, kind of like if they can work 3/4 of the time or half amount of the time, that is usually ideal and does help. Sometimes people have that option. Sometimes people really just wake up one day and their illness makes them just completely disabled and unable to work.
Right.
Finding whatever small light at the end of the tunnel you can have and allowing that to anchor it, and then being on the journey with them from getting to point A to point B. Because everybody's journey is so different.
Right.
But grieving the loss of what their life was and the expectation, and finding a new normal with the understanding that most illnesses, you don't know what's particularly going to be next. You're kind of always finding a new normal.
Right.
So it's kind of like getting used to that flexibility and really learning to be flexible as much as you can physically, but mentally. And that's
like what you
that's
said.
Challenging.
Yeah. The acceptance part. If we go into it accepting that every day is going to look different, we don't know what's going to happen, then we don't have to wake up, or accepting that, I always say, accepting that it's going to be a fresh new hell every day, which is a hard pill to swallow. What, I know this isn't in the questions, but I was wondering as we're talking, what is your number one coping skill that you give to clients, or maybe something that you use for pain? Because I know a lot of people have pain, and pain is also a lot of co-occurring with depression too. Because so what is the number one coping skill a client can do outside of pharmaceuticals that works, or that I mean, with practice? Of course, it's not going to take away your pain, but what is something they can do?
One of the first things that I share with people, and it often gets a giggle, but I find having a timed pity party to be extremely helpful.
Oh, I love it.
You know, I find setting a timer on my phone for 10 minutes, and in those 10 minutes, I curse the world, I scream, I grumble, I really, you know, get it all out, curse up a storm, throw a hissy fit, and then when the timer goes off, I take a deep breath and start putting one foot in front of the other again. And sometimes you might have to do that a couple of times that day.
Right.
But you being in control of when you have that outburst helps. Doesn't take away the pain completely, but it can make you feel damn good.
Right. Because all day long, you have to fight and pretend and mask. And for 10 minutes, you're letting yourself just like, for me, it would be like a slew of F-bombs. Just like,
right?
Just like, F this. Yes. And I used to go into, when I was waitressing, into the freezer. It was so cold. I loved it. And just scream. And that's another, to just let it. So pretty much like give yourself the permission to have a pity party and get it out, and then to regroup. Because if we stay in the pity party, then what happens?
You get stuck. You get stuck. And, you know, the pain, whether it's MS, whether it's RSD, you know, bad back, herniated discs, the pain is going to be amplified by the stress that you experience. So if you can reduce your stress in any way, it can help the pain not become more amplified. So, you know, anything that does reduce that helps. And if you stay in a state of the pity party, life will look bleak and you lose the control. So you want to, you know, make sure that you always are hanging on to a thread. If it can become stronger, it can become stronger, but it's not, you know, you're not going to have the quality of life that you have the opportunity to have if you stay in that mindset.
So to give yourself permission, but make sure you get out. Otherwise, you're going to get stuck almost like quicksand, and it's going to suck you down, and you're not, it's going to be harder. Yeah. So along the lines of the coping skill, what is a typical session? What does it look like with a client with complex medical illness?
What's nice about the different styles of therapy, the CBT and the ACT, is that it's structured and it usually kind of comes with a built flow. So it allows you to learn, you know, specific skills of reframing your thoughts, how to be more flexible with, you know, your thinking patterns. So each session usually, you know, I try to set it off with a good note. I usually ask some, you know, what something that positive happened since last week. So this way we're not starting off with a doom and gloom or maybe being delayed as, you know, a doctor's appointment. So, you know, kind of set a different tone. And then we, you know, depending upon where we are in some of the structured therapy styles, we'll pick up there. If it's initial, it is really allowing there to be time to build rapport, to get an understanding of what their illness is, because I'm not a medical doctor and I'm not familiar with every illness. It's allowing their that space to be there for me to learn and to learn about their, you know, their life. And each session, absolutely making sure that they walk away with a new coping skill.
Oh, I love that.
YouTube is like my best friend. I'm not techie, but YouTube is really good with finding short meditations. You know, definitely just different CBT skills that they can practice while they're away. But it's, you know, kind of starting off with a little bit of a recap of the previous week, learning skills, showing how it can be implemented every day outside of the session. I always want them to be able to walk away with something. And when I first start working with somebody, I really describe, we're going to build a toolbox. And in that toolbox, we're going to throw so many skills in that you can take with you when you do, you know, it's okay to be in therapy for long periods of time, but these are action oriented. I want somebody to be able to have a toolbox that they take with them.
I was just going to say that you're building their toolbox with them by giving them one coping skill after each session. I love that. So if you could tell somebody newly diagnosed, if you could give them some tips with, I'm going to start all over. If you could tell a newly diagnosed client one thing, what would it be?
It's going to be a little bit morbid, but that's the nature of chronic illness. Get a insurance policy. Regardless of how old you are, see what kind of an insurance policy you can get or add to it.
Okay.
I say that because there are some very dark days that we can experience.
Okay.
And it anchors you, because if you do anything to harm yourself, or if you commit suicide, your family will not get the payout. So the days that you don't want to live for yourself anymore, you know that you're living for somebody else.
So life insurance policy.
And if it's not like the life insurance policy specifically, like finding that one thing. That when you hit bottom, you know you can't not keep going.
So it's finding that one thing outside of yourself that you care about more than yourself, because there's going to be dark days where you don't think you can make it or want to live.
And everybody, you know, like I start with the insurance policy because it's tangible and it makes sense. But it is finding that one thing that no matter what will give you the strength to get up out of bed. That one thing that says, you know what, if I'm not here tomorrow, oh my God, what would happen to that person?
Because so for people who have been through that dark day in their life, and I think that that's the only way out, if you get past to the next day, how do you feel?
You build on it. I think that's really where you come back to, that life is a marathon. It's not a sprint. And, you know, it comes down to getting through your AM hours, getting through your PM hours. Monday turns into Tuesday. Tuesday somehow turns into Wednesday. And even when somebody's experiencing very dark days, there are ways that they can start to identify that there's movement within their own mind, that there is, you know, they can see more light. So it's allowing them to just kind of stack up days, start to see that, you know, they are able to go in a more positive direction, or at least a more forward direction.
That brings me to like the comorbidity of pain and depression. So what advice do you have for people who are suffering with hopelessness that this is going to be my life forever? How do you, because somebody with depression is already, I usually say, the hardest, like harder than anxiety, because an anxious client is like, okay, I'm anxious. You could like do something. You could like teach them something. You could help them calm down. But someone who's so depressed that they don't even see the hope, it's so hard to like convince them that there is hope. What are some of your go-tos that you use for your depressed plus pain clients?
I definitely advocate, if they haven't already seen a psychiatrist, to at least see a psychiatrist and get some advice, because the depression can be debilitating. And, you know, they're having medication, it can be really seen as just a tool that is in the toolbox. So I definitely advocate, you know, if they don't already have that, definitely see a psychiatrist. I allow myself to be open. I'll talk to psychiatrists. I'll talk to pain management doctors, letting them know that there's a team, that when they are hopeless, that they have people that they can depend on. And I'm not sure how familiar people are, but there's a short story called The Big Black Dog. And it really is a short way of explaining how depression is and how it can be seen as overwhelming, but it can also be seen as small as a chihuahua. So it's kind of, you know, letting just anything that helps bring the darkness down, anything that minimizes it, if it's medication, if it's, you know, different mindfulness techniques, finding things that they enjoy each day, anything that allows them to just, you know, kind of take a step out of the darkness or bring the darkness down. For me, it's, you know, always making sure I got a ton of books on my Kindle, because I know I want to get to the end of the book. It's, you know, just finding things that help you just move forward. Hopelessness is extremely tough. So I kind of say we want to get it down to the lowest possible number. So, you know, we love to put things on scales of 1 to 10 in our field. If your, you know, depression is a 9 or a 10, I don't think that, you know, we're going to get it to a 0. Let's be realistic.
Yes.
But I want to get it down one number at a time, lowest possible decibel. Let's get it down to like a 3. But if we have to start getting it to a 7, whatever we got to do to get the number down, to bring the hopelessness, minimize it more. If that makes sense.
Yeah, no, it makes a lot of sense. And one of the things that, because my last guest and the episode hasn't aired yet, we talked about dementia and like with aging parents and dementia. And I know that depression and dementia, like it's hard not to be hopeless, whether it's depression or not. When you're diagnosed with something that's progressive and chronic and like grieving your mind and body, like that's so hard. And this is your specialty. This is what you listen to all day long. Oh my gosh.
And people ask me that too. They're like, how do you do this all day? But you know what though? Because people do need help. And you know, everyone is different. So their toolbox is going to be different. But I am passionate about this. And, you know, I don't understand how people can work with kids anymore. True. You know, people that work in substance abuse. I don't know, more power
couples.
To them. Right?
Yeah.
You know, there's absolutely specialties that I've been exposed to, but would not be what I want to do.
Yeah.
I want to be able to help somebody have a quality of life, however that quality of life looks for them. I just want to help them get to that next day. How to hang on. If I got to hold their hand and hang on with them, that's what I want to do.
Right. And the world is so, I just am so grateful that the world has someone like you to hold their hand and want to work with them. And one of the great things about virtual too, is I just imagine for the people in pain and depressed and can't get out of bed, all they have to do is like show up to the meeting. Just show up and we'll talk through it together. And even if we say nothing, at least like you're showing up. So technology is awesome in that way too.
It is. It is because, you know, the reality is I absolutely do not think that I would be able to work with clients, you know, due to their challenges. Getting, you know, to an appointment might absolutely be impossible for them, right, depending upon, you know, what they have going on. And I say, you can come in pajamas. Your hair doesn't need to be done. I wear headbands half the time. So, you know, like, but it is, it's just, you come and where you, in this field in particular, having flexibility of sometimes the session might not be the full hour. Sometimes they can only be there for a half hour. And you know what? Yeah. That is great. And we will work with that. So it has a little bit of a different attendance policy than maybe a different specialty, but somebody can come for a half hour. It's better than them not coming at all.
Right. Meeting them where they're at.
Yeah.
Going back to that.
Yeah.
So what is one of the misconceptions of therapy or chronic illness that you would love to debunk?
That the person's lazy, mm-hmm. that the person does not want to get better or to try and decrease that hopelessness, that they do things for attention.
Right.
That
especially
me.
At 14 years old, being a girl, you must be trying to get attention. Yeah.
That, having, you know, just that misconception, because a lot of illnesses are invisible. Mm-hmm. Even back pain is, you know, until they really start doing the testing, is invisible. Having somebody understand that I'm not trying to not work. I'm not trying to not live. I'm not trying to not do A, B, or C. I am not lazy. Something is going on. It's not in my mind. I'm not hysterical. I'm not, you know, histrionic. I'm not, you know, the laziness piece, mm-hmm. I think, is just absolutely key, and that you're doing something for attention. I was the youngest of four. I didn't need more attention.
I dislike the word lazy in general. I just want to get it out of the vocabulary, because there is a reason why our body doesn't want to do something, or emotionally why we don't want to do something. And by calling somebody lazy, it's putting a label, a criticism on their character, like they're unmotivated or, you know, want to mooch off of people or whatever it may be. I mean, there are those types mm-hmm. of people out there, but that's not what we're talking about. You mentioned redefining, this goes back to the word lazy, redefining your definition of success in your Break Free from Compassion blog. How do you help others reclaim a meaningful life of their own on their own terms?
Finding what your identity is almost outside of what the illness is. You know, finding out that, you know, because that is just one aspect of you. Who are you? I'm, you know, I'm a wife, I'm an aunt, I'm a friend. I'm somebody who is, that does suffer from an illness, but that's not just who I am. So I think it's finding what your identity is and, you know, what your story is. And that's what I think narrative helps with. It does help you. What is success to you? Is it getting through the day? Is it getting a degree? Is it, you know, finding what allows you to move forward? And redefining who you are and what, you know, really is your success story.
I think that's a great thing. And it could be generalized in different areas, because I remember when I first started my career, it was, I think, you know, the crash of 2008 or whatever, a lot of men, a lot of people in general, men were going into therapy because they were depressed, because they had lost their identity, their job. So in everything we do, that I think it's important to kind of like spread it out a little bit. Don't have something be your one big thing, because in case that goes away, there has to be other things available to you.
And the opposite's true. If, you know, you don't, if the only thing that you really feel that defines you is that hopelessness, is that anxiety, is that chronic illness, that's just going to weigh you down. That's not going to allow you to be free.
Yes, you are right. I think it's a hard balance, because it's on one hand, you don't want to dismiss it, like dismiss yourself or in your feelings, or dismiss it on other people. But sometimes it does become your identity. And I was just saying to somebody before that sometimes, people don't know what to do without exercising every day or being on some type of like eating regimen because that's part of their identity. Well, what else is important to you outside of that?
Mm-hmm.
So you're right. So
ACT is really good with helping you identify different values that you have. And that allows you to kind of see things differently. So there's so many different techniques in acceptance and commitment therapy that really kind of join with cognitive behavioral. And you're forced to look at your different values. You're forced to look at the different shades of your life, different seasons of your life. It really forces you to look outside.
Hi, everyone. Karen's power went out on her side at the end of our podcast recording, so I'm going to summarize the last part of our conversation for you. Karen recently shared a great blog about how your office setup can actually help save your energy. She highlights five simple but effective ways to make your workspace more supportive, like using ergonomic furniture to reduce physical strain, adding plants or aromatherapy to create a calming atmosphere, and organizing space to minimize distractions. These small changes can really help protect your energy and boost your well-being throughout the day. If you want to learn more, you can check out her blog and find her at Anam Kara Counseling and Supervision LLC.com. That's Anam, A-N-A-M, Kara, C-A-R-A, Counseling and Supervision LLC.com. I want to thank Karen for taking the time to talk to me and sharing her story and knowledge. Thanks for listening, and please take care of yourself. Before we go, Aurora Healing Crew, take a deep breath like you're soaking in sunlight. Warm, steady, grounding. As you move through your day, check in with your gut. Notice how you feel around others. Your energy is precious. Protect it so you have the strength and light to do what really matters to you, because life is hard and we're getting through it together. Thank you for listening to the Aurora Sessions Beyond the Couch. Visit our website at aurorasuncounseling.com to learn more. You can find us on Instagram, TikTok, Facebook, LinkedIn, and YouTube. Just search Aurora Sun Counseling. Got questions or topics you'd love to hear us cover? Email us at info@aurorasuncounseling.com or drop a comment. We'd love to hear from you.